Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka with another episode, continuing with Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga, in Chapter 2. That which nature has evolved for us and has firmly founded is the bodily life. She has effected a certain combination and harmony of the two inferior but most fundamentally necessary elements of our action and progress upon earth. Matter, which, however the two ethereally spiritual may despise it, is our foundation and the first condition of all our energies and realizations, and the life energy, which is our means of existence in a material body, and the basis there even of our mental and spiritual activities. She has successfully achieved a certain stability of her constant material movement, which is at once sufficiently steady and durable and sufficiently pliable and mutable to provide a fit dwelling place and instrument for the progressively manifesting God in humanity. This is what is meant by the fable in the Atharva Upanishad, which tells us that the gods rejected the animal forms successfully offered to them by the divine self, and only when man was produced cried out, "This indeed is perfectly made," and consented to enter in. She has effected also a working compromise between the inertia of matter and the active life that lives in and feeds on it, by which not only is vital existence sustained, but the fullest developments of mentality are rendered possible. This equilibrium constitutes the basic status of nature in man, and is termed in the language of yoga his gross body, composed of the material or food sheath and the nervous system or vital vehicle. If, then, this inferior equilibrium is the basis and first means of the higher movements which the universal power contemplates, and if it constitutes the vehicle in which the divine here seeks to reveal itself, and if the Indian saying is true, that the body is the instrument provided for the fulfillment of the right law of our nature, then any final recoil from the physical life must be a turning away from the completeness of the divine wisdom and a renunciation of its aims in earthly manifestation. Such a refusal may be, owing to some secret law of their development, the right attitude for certain individuals, but never the aim intended for mankind. It can be, therefore, no integral yoga which ignores the body or makes its annulment or its rejection indispensable to a perfect spirituality. Rather, the perfecting of the body also should be the last triumph of the spirit, and to make the bodily life also divine must be God's final seal upon his work in the universe. The obstacle which the physical presents to the spiritual is no argument for the rejection of the physical. For in the unseen providence of things, our greatest difficulties are our best opportunities. A supreme difficulty is nature's indication to us of a supreme conquest to be won and an ultimate problem to be solved. It is not a warning of an inextricable snare to be shunned, or of an enemy too strong for us from whom we must flee. Equally, the vital and nervous energies in us are there for a great utility. They too demand the divine realization of their possibilities in our ultimate fulfillment. The great part assigned to this element in the universal scheme is powerfully emphasized by the Catholic wisdom of the Upanishads. As the spokes of a wheel in its nave, so in the life energy is all established. The triple knowledge and the sacrifice and the power of the strong and the purity of the wise. Under the control of the life energy is all this that is established in the triple heaven. It is, therefore, no integral yoga that kills these vital energies, forces them into a nerveless quiescence, or roots them out as the source of noxious activities. Their purification, not their destruction. Their transformation, control, and utilization is the aim in view with which they have been created and developed in us. If the bodily life is what nature has firmly evolved for us as her base and first instrument, it is our mental life that she is evolving as her immediate next aim and superior instrument. This, in her ordinary exaltations, is the lofty, preoccupying thought in her. This, except in her periods of exhaustion and recoil into a reposeful and recuperating obscurity, is her constant pursuit wherever she can get free from the trammels of her first vital and physical realizations. For here in man, we have a distinction which is of the utmost importance. He has in him not a single mentality, but a double and a triple. The mind material and nervous, the pure intellectual mind, which liberates itself from the illusions of the body and the senses, and a divine mind above intellect, which in its turn liberates itself from the imperfect modes of the logically discriminative and imaginative reason. Mind in man is first enmeshed in the life of the body, where in the plant it is entirely involved and in animals always imprisoned. It accepts this life as not only the first, but the whole condition of its activities, and serves its needs as if they were the entire aim of existence. But the bodily life in man is a base, not the aim, his first condition and not his last determinant. In the just idea of the ancients, man is essentially the thinker, the manu, the mental being who leads the life and the body, not the animal who is led by them. The true human existence, therefore, only begins when the intellectual mentality emerges out of the material, and we begin more and more to live in the mind, independent of the nervous and physical obsession, and in the measure of that liberty, are able to accept rightly and rightly to use the life of the body. For freedom, and not a skillful subjection, is the true means of mastery. A free, not a compulsory acceptance of the conditions, the enlarged and sublimated conditions of our physical being, is the high human ideal. But beyond this intellectual mentality is the divine. The mental life thus evolving in man is not indeed a common possession. In actual appearance, it would seem as if it were only developed to the fullest in individuals, and as if there were great numbers and even the majority in whom it is either a small and ill-organized part of their normal nature or not evolved at all, or latent and not easily made active. Certainly, the mental life is not a finished evolution of nature. It is not yet firmly founded in the human animal. The sign is that the fine and full equilibrium of vitality and matter, the sane, robust, long-lived human body, is ordinarily found only in races or classes of men who reject the effort of thought, its disturbances, its tensions, or think only with the material mind. Civilized man has yet to establish an equilibrium between the fully active mind and the body. He does not normally possess it. Indeed, the increasing effort towards a more intense mental life seems to create frequently an increasing disequilibrium of the human elements, so that it is possible for eminent scientists to describe genius as a form of insanity, a result of degeneration, a pathological morbidity of nature. The phenomena which are used to justify this exaggeration, when taken not separately, but in connection with all other relevant data, point to a different truth. Genius is one attempt of the universal energy to so quicken and intensify our intellectual powers that they shall be prepared for those more puissant, direct, and rapid faculties which constitute the play of the supra-intellectual or divine mind. It is not, then, a freak, an inexplicable phenomenon, but a perfectly natural next step in the right line of her evolution. She has harmonized the bodily life with the material mind. She is harmonizing it with the play of the intellectual mentality. For that, although it tends to a depression of the full animal and vital vigor, need not produce active disturbances. And she is shooting yet beyond in the attempt to reach a still higher level. Nor are the disturbances created by her process as great as is often represented. Some of them are the crude beginnings of new manifestations. Others are an easily corrected movement of disintegration, often fruitful of fresh activities, and always a small price to pay for the far-reaching results that she has in view. We will pause at this point for today and continue with Chapter 2 from Sri Aurobindo's Synthesis of Yoga in the next episode. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. May there be light where there is darkness, in each one and everywhere. Bye for now. Marlanka signing off.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.